Well, good morning, everyone. Here on Wall Street and out there, near and far, in the Mahasangha, the great Sangha, which extends far beyond our little storefront here. And our neighborhood. I'm going to talk about our neighborhood this morning. And we're going to include something a little bit unusual in our practice today. After this talk and after our service, which will be a well-being and memorial service, usually on a half-day retreat schedule, we would have another period of zazen. But instead, we're going to go next door. To the park. It's called Oxford Park, but maybe it will get a new name before long. We're going to go to the opening ceremony for the new indigenous food forest, which is being created there. It's an initiative of the Vancouver Urban Food Forest Foundation in partnership with our landlords and neighbors, the Aboriginal Mother Center Society, who live and operate in the upper two floors of this building. This building, by the way, is owned by us, the taxpayers. It's operated by BC Housing, which is, I guess, sort of a, I don't know if it's a crown corporation or what it is. or it's a ministry or a, but anyway, we are actually the owners of it as taxpayers, and Aboriginal Mothers Society is the primary leaseholder, and we have a sublease, and that's really great that our rent goes to support them rather than who knows, a corporate landlord of some sort. So we thought this would be a good way to connect and learn and to support our neighbors to go to this ceremony. There's going to be various components to the ceremony. And I want to read you a little bit of the description from the website of the Vancouver Urban Food Forest Foundation. This is their story. In the spring of 2020, a group of like-minded community members decided to tackle the effects of COVID-19 by bringing people together with food. We realized that a crucial way to help with the alienation and food shortages we saw in our neighborhood was to establish a collective garden and food forest. We actually first came up with the idea, though, in 2018, when we observed there was a serious need for more community gardens in this neighborhood of 34,000 people. But at the time, our chosen park was not available. In time, our vision evolved from the allotment model of community gardening, which is what the little community garden down the street is, where people have their personal plots. So evolving from that model to a philosophy of sharing harvests, collective gardening, and food forests, being guided by indigenous ways of knowing, prioritizing marginalized voices, and creating a hub for mutual aid. Our mission has continued to expand and deepen alongside our growing ties to this community. In April 2020, we proposed this new community-based intergenerational and cross-cultural knowledge-sharing space to the Vancouver Park Board. It was very much aligned with their new local food system action plan, so the Burrard View Park project was approved in concept in March 2021. On March 30th, 2022, the southeast site of Burrard View Park was officially approved by the Park Board, and development will likely start this fall. We have also recently been approved to develop a smaller sister indigenous food forest, also located on Wall Street, so right next door, and we'll begin development in May or June of 2022. While we waited for approval of the first of these first sites, we spent time connecting with our neighbors in meaningful ways, conducting workshops with partnering organizations, and spreading the word about food justice as a tool for systemic change. We created and facilitated an event called Neighborhood Food Week, which took place from September 20th to 26th of 2021 in Hastings Sunrise, which is our neighborhood. And then, on June 21st, which was just less than a month ago, a couple weeks ago, Indigenous Peoples Day, after 2 years, they were able to break ground and begin planting the food forest next door. I don't know if anyone here stopped by. It was a Tuesday, so a little harder for people to get there on a work day. More than 60 people came out, apparently, and made the newspapers to plant Indigenous trees, shrubs, flowers, ground covers, and to lay down burlap sacks and cardboard to protect the garden soil from the sun and the elements. So today, there will be a celebration to bless the garden, the food forest, and to name it the Chen Chen Stwe Healing Garden. There will be a blanketing ceremony, a naming ceremony, a blessing by the host elders of the host nations here, a traditional drummer and dancer, and a free lunch prepared by the Aboriginal Mother Society to share in community. So Chen Chen Stwe is the Squamish name given to the garden, and they hope to the park itself one day. Is Oxford Park. pretty colonial name. And the Chen Chen Stwe means to stand and work together. To stand and work together, and to hold each other up. So it expresses the concept of mutual aid. So all this has a kind of timely and particular resonance for me since Michael and I just got back from spending a few days up on the Sunshine Coast, walking through the coastal ecosystems and appreciating the plant and animal life around us. The rainforest ecosystem is pretty familiar, but what we don't see as often is that ecosystem that's kind of on the dry, rocky, sunny cliffs where the arbutus trees grow. And it was just so beautiful. I mean, arbutus trees are kind of magical, beautiful trees themselves, the way they shed their bark and underneath is this smooth, green skin, just amazing color, then which turns darker and redder. And it has these, in the fall, these strange strawberry-like fruits. It's just this marvelous tree. But there are also very unusual, in particular, wildflowers. It's almost like an alpine environment because it's rocky and dry, like a rock garden. So we were just busily identifying them, and Michael found some kind of app where you can take the photograph and it'll tell you what it is. That seems a little like cheating to me. But you have to work a little harder. But also, I find it quite wonderful, and the apps don't so much tell you this, but I have a couple of really good books that tell you how Indigenous peoples use these plants in just amazing and varied ways. And sometimes we find out that really plants that we assumed had been here all along were in fact introduced several hundred years ago and are along with colonization. and some with quite harmful effects and some with less. The most common one that we all know is another one, even more, even blackberries, yeah, the Himalayan blackberries.
English ivy.
English ivy for sure, and dandelions.
Oh, dandelions.
Dandelions. And broom, yeah.
Broom.
Yeah, broom is a serious one for people with allergies. And it's very hard to eradicate. And it's not, many of these, the shrubby ones, don't provide as effective or as nourishing habitat for birds. And they crowd out the native shrubs. So one thing we learned up on the Sunshine Coast is there are some very active groups dedicated to study, education, and protection of these coastal and rainforest environments. And they have done better than average work of creating signage, educational signage. You know, some educational signage is pretty basic or unattractive. But they do, theirs is really informative and really well done. And so one thing I learned was that the rainforest plant we call Devil's Club. Do people know what Devil's Club looks like? It's big. The leaves can be quite large. They're maple-shaped. But the underneath is they're spiny. And the stems, it can be quite thick when they're big, are just spiky, covered with spikes. And there are bright red berries in the fall that look like they might be super poisonous. So the whole thing is like a pretty intimidating plant. You don't want to grab it when you lose your balance on the trail. But it's actually a highly valued in indigenous traditions for its medicinal and spiritual properties, contrary to its kind of fearsome appearance. So I just want to... and also I read that the spines, the spiny leaves, will give some people quite a strong skin reaction. So it's a plant to respect and use with care. But I just wanted to read you some of the ways that it was valued and used, was and is. It's related to ginseng, actually. And it's one of the most important of all medicinal plants. The roots, especially the greenish inner bark. So whoever, you know, I never peeled a Devil's Club stem. Now I want to. The greenish inner bark, we used for numerous ailments, including arthritis, ulcers, digestive tract ailments, and diabetes. Was considered a highly powerful plant that can protect against evil influences of many kinds. Devil's Club sticks are used as protective charms, and charcoal burned from Devil's Club is used to make a protective face paint for dancers and others who might be ritually vulnerable to harmful influences. The light-colored, lightweight wood was used for making fishing lures. The stems, the Haida people use the stems to hook octopus and black cod. The Heskiat people scraped the spines off the bark and boiled it in water with different berries to make paint and basket dye. The Straight Salish and Didydat, I don't know Didydat people, where they are, combined Devil's Club charcoal with bear grease for ceremonial face painting and inserting under the skin to make a blue tattoo. So they used it for tattoo ink. A black dye was made by burning Devil's Club and mixing the ashes with water. Root and stem used as cleansing emetic and purgative, and in steam baths for rheumatism and stomach trouble. arthritis. The Cowlitz people dried the bark and pulverized it for a perfume or baby talc, and made an infusion drunk for colds and applied topically for rheumatism. Yeah, again, hot baths. The Lushootseed people steeped the stems and drank the tea for colds and pulverized the bark to use for deodorant. So, you know, if we get really hard up, remember this. You know, if the supply chain for deodorant. But this is marvelous. It's just, you know, every part. Oh, the berries. The berries. Oh, the Lummi people applied the dethorned bark to a woman's breast to stop the flow of milk. Right? The devil's club berries were rubbed in the scalp to combat lice and dandruff and make the hair shiny. It just goes on and on. Face paint, arthritis, yeah. And even today, tea from the inner bark is taken for diabetes. There is so much. This is a guide to plants of coastal British Columbia, and there's so much information in here. And also this one, food plants. This is classic food plants of British Columbia Indians, Coastal Peoples by Nancy Turner. This is first printing, 1975. There's so much I'd like to share in here, like, okay, skunk cabbage. You know what skunk cabbage looks like? You know what it smells like?
Skunks.
Skunky. And it grows in swamps. In the spring, and it's one of the first signs of spring is this yellow, I think it's called a spathe. It's like, so the rootstocks were considered starvation food if you're really desperate. But what was the really helpful, really useful part of skunk cabbage was what? Leaves, yeah. Plastic wrap. Eliminate plastic wrap. Skunk cabbage leaves. And it didn't create any taste contamination. Lining baskets with skunk cabbage leaves, because the leaves are huge. They can be quite big. And arrowhead, it's named for the shape of the leaves, shaped like an arrowhead. Called its indigenous name is Wapato, and the tubers were a major and are still a significant source of food for the Stolo people, especially the Katsi, who live in the Maple Ridge area. And it says families within the Katsi people owned Wapato sites. They would establish claims for a season by clearing tracts of land several hundred feet long of other growth in order to have better access to the tubers. By the following year, the patches would have grown up again and become common property. A family claiming one of these tracts might camp beside it for a month or more while harvesting the tubers, often by canoe, leaning over and pulling the plants out of the shallow water. Raw and unwashed, they would keep for several months. They were cooked as needed by baking in hot ashes. And they have a sweetish flavor reminiscent of chestnuts. So I was looking at the website of the Katsi people because of their connection with the UBC Research Forest, where Loon Lake Retreat Center, where we go in November, and they have some management agreements with UBC around the Loon Lake, or the the research forest. And I saw on their website that they are maintaining and creating and maintaining these Wapato harvest sites in the Pitt River marshes. So I would really like to go, and they recruit volunteers to go help out. So that's something I would like to find out more about. So many, as you, the more you learn about these uses, so you realize that so many of the plants have both potentially poisonous properties and potentially healing properties to learn about. And so this brought to mind a story from a koan that I've shared before, but I want to tell it again in this context. It's from the Blue Cliff Record, case 87. And the koan itself is just a quote from Zen Master Yunmen. And you've heard this before, some of you. Medicine and disease subdue each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself? Medicine and disease subdue each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself? So at first glance, this seems counterintuitive, right? Isn't it the purpose of medicine to subdue disease? But of course, medicine is not always successful, is it? Sometimes the disease is too powerful. Sometimes we don't know how to treat it. Sometimes the chemotherapy fails, or the infection resists the antibiotic. We've used so many antibiotics that we have created these super bugs that are resistant to antibiotics. Sometimes the antidepressant does more harm than good. But maybe the meaning here in this koan goes beyond this battle metaphor of medicine versus subduing disease. Maybe it's that medicine and disease are two sides of the same coin, or they co-arise as we use that co-arising, mutually dependent. One can't exist without the other, just like life and death, and light and darkness, enlightenment and delusion, the relative and the absolute, simultaneously existing and mutually necessary, rather than oppositional. And this is a pretty radical concept. And if we are too attached to one or the other, if we're too aversive to the one and too attached to the other, we get snagged and we suffer. Yeah. This is a kind of fundamental teaching. So in the commentary to this koan, in the Blue Cliff Record, it tells the story of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, and his disciple Sudana. So one day Manjushri asks Sudana to go out into the forest, perhaps, or into the meadows, and pick some medicinal herbs, saying, "If there is something that is not medicine, bring it to me." So all day Sudana searched all over. He could not find anything that was not medicine. So he had to go back to Manjushri and say, "There is nothing that is not medicine." So Manjushri said, "Gather something that is medicine." And Sudana picked up a blade of grass and gave it to Manjushri. Manjushri held it up and showed it to the assembly, to all the monks, and said, "This medicine can kill people, and it can also bring people to life." And isn't that so? When we look at plant medicine, there are plants that can heal or kill depending on the dosage, the method of preparation, and the sensitivity of the individual. And this is the knowledge that indigenous people all over the world have learned and passed on by close observation, sometimes noticing how animals use these plants when they're sick. But also, each experience in our lives can kill us or bring us to life, right? You know those things where you think, "Oh, it's the end of the world." depending on how we meet it, yeah. A parking ticket. Getting towed at the wrong time. Ah, it's the end of the world. Or getting lost on a hike in the mountains. Or the end of a relationship. Or a cancer diagnosis. Can kill us or bring us to life. If you were here, was it just last Monday, the Wednesday before last? Vicky, talked to us about her breast cancer recurrence and how it kind of brought her to life, snapped her into a kind of heightened awareness of life. So if the whole earth is medicine, then even poison can be transformed into nourishment. The Tibetan Lojong teaching goes, turn all adverse circumstances, all adversity, into the path. How do we meet adversity? How do we meet what we didn't expect, what we didn't want, and turn it into the path? Open it up. Open up our view. Open up our heart. Open up our mind. We will inevitably meet illness, accident, aging, and all the misfortunes that, like not getting the job you really wanted, or having our beloved say they no longer want to be with us, all those things, you know, we dread, or we just completely don't expect, and then it happens. How do we transform the aversion, that aversion that arises in our minds, into wisdom and compassion? I would say this is what the whole technology of our practice is designed to do. It's really to meet suffering and to turn it, to open it. Indigenous peoples learned the wisdom of plants over generations, as I said, through close observation, looking, listening, smelling, tasting. Learning the healing and the poisonous qualities of the plant, of plants, and the careful through careful discernment and learning how to prepare the different parts of plants. So much detail. The tubers of blue camas. Blue camas is one of the plants that grows in that sort of, there's a name for it, but that sort of dry, rocky, coastal, warm, sunny, exposed ecosystems. And the roots are nutritious and tasty. And blue camas grows interspersed with death camas, which is deathly poisonous. So you have to learn the difference. The root, the tubers look almost the same. So for us, you know, who are pretty ignorant, the only way we could be really sure is to pick one that's blooming. I'm not saying go out and do this, because if we all started doing it, we would quickly eradicate blue camas. It's endangered enough already because of habitat loss. But to me, it's deeply moving and absolutely amazing that indigenous peoples attained and transmitted so much knowledge without any written language, all orally, all experientially and orally transmitted through, you know, incredible capacity for memory. They had no field guides and they had no apps. So this is very much akin to the technology of the Dharma. You know, these practices that have been passed on first through hundreds of years, just, or you know, through oral and experiential transmission, through observation, close observation of the mind and body, right? And applying appropriate means to transform the mind, to make it supple and effective in living a life of benefit to others, to self and others. So much of the technology of meditation And when I say technology, I mean specific practices, right? Much of that technology is devoted to bringing awareness to states of mind that are toxic, that are harmful, and applying the healing medicines of loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, joy, the Brahmaviharas practices, the paramitas, patience, generosity, ethical conduct, energy, wisdom, concentration, and every single one of those. If you look at loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy, has a toxic extreme or a harm taken too far in one direction. It's often called in the teachings about the Brahmaviharas, the near and the far enemies. So and I can't go into it too far, but for example, the equanimity, the near enemy, let me get this right, the near enemy is the quality that is obviously the opposite, right? So opposite of compassion is the is cruelty. But the I didn't include this, but I want to tell you it. And so I want to get it right. The near enemy or the far enemy. Is the near. So one is the opposite, and the other is actually almost like, can be mistaken for, but it's contaminated by self-clinging. So in terms of compassion, it would be compassion that's contaminated by your agenda to be a good, compassionate person, or to accommodate someone else's needs to the point of where you're doing harm to yourself or someone else. Those are the near enemy. The near enemies are the ones where it might look like, but it's not, right? And then the far enemy is the opposite. Yeah. So you see this, even these qualities that we think are such good qualities, patience, taken too far, there's the potential for toxicity and harm. And so each one, and these qualities then balance each other, right? So then you bring in equanimity. So this is a technology developed by practice, right? And close observation, just like this plant knowledge. And I just think that's, and this was done before there was the plethora of Dharma books, before there was Banyan books where you could go and Dharma apps, right? And those are great. They're helpful because we didn't learn these things from childhood. None of us learned these things. Dharma wisdom or plant wisdom, we didn't learn growing up, most of us. And so we do need the books, we do need the apps, but none of them can substitute completely for direct experience, for direct observation. Direct experience, and sometimes also a friend or an elder to walk along with. Someone who can say, hey, look at those red berries. Do not eat them. Look at these leaves. These are the ones. This is the shape of water hemlock. Do not eat it. And this is cow parsnip. And that's fine. You know, or to say, listen to those scratchy little sounds, and there in that shrub is a family of teeny tiny little winter wrens and their mom cheeping that you would have walked right by if your friend hadn't heard that little sound. Or a friend who can notice just what a miserable, painful state you're in and say, wow, what's going on? Here's some good Dharma medicine. You can make for yourself. You can make it yourself with a little practice. Right? So, I hope that as we watch the indigenous food forest grow over the coming months and years, and maybe some of us will help out a little, that we will learn a little bit more about the plants that grow here in this land and their gifts and their hazards. As I said, I'm not suggesting we all become exclusive hunter-gatherers because we'd be pretty destructive because there's so many of us. And already we are over-harvesting certain kinds of wild foods. But we can learn and use and taste judiciously. And maybe that kind of attentiveness and care and reverence and gratitude that indigenous people bring and are reviving and sharing in their relationship with native plants can also be a teaching and a model for us in our Dharma practice. So we are grateful for this work being done to share and revive this plant wisdom, and I hope we can all go over and offer our support and presence today. So thank you all for listening. What we'll do is we'll chant our Dharma talk closing chant, and then we'll go right into service. And then after service, we'll just regroup and go over to the park together. Okay?
So page 3 of your chant books.
May our intention